I wasn't on screen yet, and all I heard was or something. I don't know.
So you can hear it through the mic, eh?
Oh yeah, it's no big deal. It's only it's only charming background noise.
It's you know, we have I think we have about 20. Yeah. Oh yeah. So you can hear it, eh?
Yeah. Check.
Perfect background for the for the podcast, eh?
I'm actually loving it.
Welcome back to Upon the Horizon. By the way, we never say that. It's been a been a few minutes.
Yeah. Oh, we're recording. Check. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, we're recording, man. How you doing?
Thank you, Jay. Thank you. Sorry. Let me get serious now. Let me get professional. Okay. All right. And now, namaste. Now I'm in the podcast.
Now you're who you really are. Now you're really Sean. Before you weren't ready. Yeah.
I caught you before off guard. Before I was just having fun with Jay Sean. Now it's Sean and Jay on a podcast, Sean.
You see the wonderful studio I have? This is my outdoor kitchen.
Dude, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. I can't really show you around, but you've been in a camper. You know how fun it is.
Much of a tour. I mean, come on, we've all been in some sort of a chicken barn. What is even going on back there, buddy?
It's literally built exactly like a horse shelter.
Is it?
Yeah, but it works. It keeps the...
So as when you say your outdoor kitchen, is that now the kind of temporary or permanent setup since the house burned down?
Yeah, it's temporary. So I think we've got another 6 or 8 months before we'll be back in the house. And
damn,
I love to cook.
Good, man, for temporary.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all the way I built it is I can take it apart and replace it and turn it into a windbreak for the horses out in the barnyard in the future.
Oh, yeah,
so
nice.
Or it's actually quite nice. I built it quite nicely, so we might end up just spinning it around and leaving it as like a barbecue pit as an entertainment.
Looks like
thing.
Like you use big beams up there, or what is that? Big beams, or is that built out with the?
These are 2x6, and then these are rough sawn 4x4, and then all of this stuff here is just rough sawn 1x6. They call it cattle panel boards. It's made for livestock. You use it to create windbreaks out in your pasture. So
where'd you get it from?
We've got a construction place here that you can go and they make lumber right in their yard, and you can buy it without being kiln dried. So you can buy non kiln dried rough sawn.
Check.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like an eighth of the price of standard lumber. So
did you keep any track of a budget or any such thing like that?
Yeah.
In the sense of what generally that might have cost you to build out?
This little structure here, about $1,300 all in.
Oh wow, well done.
Yeah, no, you know, when you're a farmer, you're on a budget, so you try to do everything with used wood or with anything that's a discount. So
your neighbor's wood.
Well, I mean,
I'm just saying, just steal your neighbor's fence.
You know, when the sun goes down, those wood elves come out, eh? And
gotta wake up early to get to work to build your fence again.
Early bird gets the worm, or the pile of lumber.
The fence.
Jeez, that looks a lot like my lumber.
No, man, I used kiln dried. Yours wasn't kiln dried. Mm-hmm. I dried it out last night. Mine's kiln dried.
Yeah, I planed it all. I planed it all and finished it. Okay, so it's June 1st.
It is. And by the way, I honestly didn't put two and two together. Like, I know June is Men's Mental Health Month.
It is, yeah.
And so this morning I got a DM from Zachy Boy over on the Canadian podcast.
Yep.
And basically he said, hey, Coach Falcon, Men's Mental Health Month, hope you're going to join the team and be part of that initiative and push the good word and be supportive in any fashion that I can. And of course I rogered that and said, you know, count on me to help out however I can, whenever I can, which isn't all the time. But if I got the time, I'll make the time. And so as I was replying back to him, I was like, man, I can't believe that I didn't get in front of this yesterday or the day before to give the heads up to say, hey, you know, Men's Mental Health Month is coming. And I mean, it just seemed like last year I was more on top of it.
Well, it's June 1st and we're recording a podcast, so let's go.
Agreed. Let's friggin' go.
Yeah. Men's Mental Health Month. Let's start off recording one about that. So maybe we're obviously winging it because you just exclaimed your lack of preparedness. So
I'm
prepared, Sean. Like I'm currently prepared with a script.
Do you know what? I will say this, and I know that we don't have a script, and you probably have somewhere that you want to go with this June subject, so I'm not gonna build this out too much.
Yep.
But yesterday, I didn't go to bed until 2 o'clock this morning, and so the reason for that is I spent 4 hours absorbing everything Christopher Hitchens, and so
nice.
Man, you know, like I've watched him in the past. I've observed him from an arm's distance. But last night, yep, I got personal and I tracked 4 solid hours of him with the pure focus of Christopher Hitchens. Now, in the past, I've bumped into him and observed, yep, him. But last night was different. Last time was the laser focus on Christopher. And so what I did for the first couple of hours is I watched him in debates, debating his natural style, how he thinks, how he talks, which I was already familiar with, but again, I wanted to dive deeper on this guy. So first couple of hours watching him in debates, and then the last 2 hours what I did was watching him in debates again, as you know, that's really his arena. But I would be fast forwarding past what the guests had to say so that I could just listen to him. Because the first 2 hours, I'd formed the pattern on him. I understood how he kind of interacted, blah, blah, blah. I didn't need to see that interaction anymore, per se. What I did focus is just purely on him. This is what I came to realize. And it's because of the point that you just made. He thinks really, really deep. But he thinks deep on a subject that was quite narrow, if I can say that.
Yep.
Whereas I think nowhere near as deeply as him. And the reason I'm speaking about Sean right now is because I was looking at Christopher Hitchens to evaluate myself on how I can speak better, communicate better. And so I thought, man, I don't even come remotely close to how deep that dude thinks, but I think wider. I believe I think wider. I think I've seen maybe more than he has. And I don't want to say I've thought more about wider things. But if he's thinking deep, you can't think deep and wide simultaneously. So if you're all in to dive down as deep as you can into religion, which was his forte, I don't have a forte. I just think wide and try to think deep, but I never get as deep as Hitchens, you know? So it was just a thought last night that, man, sometimes I don't know if I've chosen correctly. You know what I'm saying? I went to apply my intellect or apply my time on the planet. Should I have gone deeper or should I have gone wider? That was my thought last night.
Yeah. I used to be unfortunately, Christopher Hitchens passed away about 7 or 8 years ago from pancreatic cancer or esophageal cancer.
I forget which cancer.
I think it was pancreatic. He was a heavy, heavy drinker anyways. I used to idolize him. And then I realized one day that what he said was profound. Like you said, he dedicated his entire life to religion. But at the same time, he was missing something because he became so engrossed with the anti-religion.
He became dogmatic.
Yeah, that he almost turned into a pariah at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because there was no empathy or compassion left in him at the end. And it wasn't because of the disease. I naturally followed him as well. And I just saw him being so stuck to it that there was nothing. God could have come down from the sky and anointed the entire planet. And Hitchens would have said, no, screw you. I don't believe in you.
Yeah. In fighting dogmatic religion, he became dogmatic about religion. And I know that that's an unfair characterization, but at a high level perspective or top down view, generally speaking, that's what I saw. Now, maybe you've got some thoughts on this because there's a young fella out there right now, and I want to say his name is Alex O'Connor or something like that. Anyway, he came onto my radar just recently, like over the last week.
Yeah.
And until a week ago, I didn't know the guy existed. But I saw him in a debate at, it might have been at Oxford. And he's British by birth, and he's very polished, and he enjoys a good debate. And he'll debate on a number of things, but he likes debating on decriminalization of marijuana. He likes debating about religion. He's a subscribed atheist, and so he's a broad thinker, deep thinker, well spoken. So he had Richard Hitchens on his show, Christopher Hitchens' brother, who I've never listened to before.
No, neither have I.
And so he came on the show, and oh boy, it was not a good showing. Now, because I didn't know anything about Richard Hitchens, as I was watching it, I was like, wow, this is unspooling fast. This is going off the rails much quicker than I thought. What is even going on here? I didn't know Hitchens had an axe to grind with anyone who this young fellow was representing. And so pretty early in the debate, which was supposed to be about an hour, Richard Hitchens went right off the rail and became like inflammatory and became kind of accusatory and saying that this guy is this, that, and the other thing, and just really out of line from my perspective. And he kind of stomped out of the podcast, left prematurely with accusations and, you know, you shouldn't publish this to the internet. You shouldn't publish this. You should feel guilty about what you've done to me here. And there's no way you should publish that. And he just kind of went off on a rant. And it was, personally, I thought it was embarrassing for him. But it was watching Richard Hitchens and thinking, how did that go so off the rails? And I saw in one of the comments that the brother has always been trying to live up to the older brother and just never really got the acclaim, never got the eyeballs on him. And so he's always been in this role of trying to act out, to seek attention, to live up in the shadow of his brother, Christopher. So I was going to ask you if you knew him, but it sounds like you didn't.
No, Richard. Once Christopher Hitchens passed, it sort of ended my following of him. So I never even heard of his brother before that. But
yeah, neither did I.
You can imagine. Oh, almost everybody, I think, when they're in a position where they're attempting to be like somebody, you have to put on a show. It's theatrics, right? So maybe it's the theatrics that's getting in the way of him being able to have a good debate, because like you said, he's got a brother who was world famous. You know, Christopher Hitchens, you probably remember when him and Dawkins and Dan Dennett and what's his name? Sam Harris. They started calling them like the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Right? Because they'd get together and have these little Toastmaster ceremonies where they'd sit around with cigarettes and alcohol and coffee and just shred religion and stuff. But Hitchens became
shred each other.
he was a martyr for anybody who had a bone to pick with religion, right? He was the poster child for the king of atheism. So how do you fill those shoes if you're his brother? And plus you got Christopher Hitchens, you know, that his argument style, even if he was wrong, nobody beat him in an argument, especially when he was doing a debate. You know, he just had that. He had that witty English humor and a way of stripping people down with knowledge, even if he was wrong. You know, like maybe there is God, but Hitchens just had this way of debating that just undressed people. And maybe his brother doesn't have that. So he has to turn to gaslighting pejorative language or whatever in order to try and fill the rest of that gap, right?
And you know, the unfortunate part of that is that Christopher Hitchens' style was, he had so many tools to achieve what he wanted to achieve, even if it was at the small cost of not doing it righteously. You know, but a debate is a debate, and I watched him almost observe it as a competition rather than as a conversation. And so I'm not going to suggest that he was there to win, but he was there to use as many tools as he could to make his point. And sometimes I feel it was a bit unfair, because sometimes he used methods that were not treacherous, but they were tricky. They were awkward. They were difficult to absorb and improvise, adapt and overcome and respond in a half a second. Because he was dropping things, and I'm not talking about from my perspective, I'm talking about the person he was talking to. From the person he was talking to's perspective, they wouldn't have much time to formulate a response from or to Hitchin, because he had just hit them with something novel. They hadn't they'd never been asked either as confrontationally or as uniquely as Hitchin did. They had never observed that before, and therefore they'd never formulated a response to it before. And therefore, even though they were typically polished speakers, sometimes you'd see this, and that's off-putting for someone who has pride as a public speaker when they're showing up in their tweed suit, staying in the fanciest of hotels, and the red carpet rolls out and they step up, and then all of a sudden it's and it's got to be off-putting.
Yeah. Well, and some people win arguments just by that, just because they're good at it. They don't even need to be right.
Correct.
Right. And Christopher Hitchens was one of those guys. I think he was correct in his analysis of religion as a sort of as like a meta analysis of religion's history. I think he was right.
Me too.
I have my own personal beliefs on religion now that don't include atheism. I wouldn't call myself atheist, but you.
Well, neither would he. On the simple categorization of a general title, he'd dial down into it a little bit more and debate you on being an atheist, you know?
I'm trying to figure out a way that we tie this into men's mental health because.
Oh, you're well beyond me, buddy. You're thinking better. You're thinking higher order than I am.
Well, we just went off on a Christopher Hitchens tangent.
I apologized at the start, I think.
I am scrubbing this all off the recording. Screw it.
You can, by the way.
I have the power.
You do.
Okay. Well, we should try and talk about men's mental health now at some point. Mm-hmm. I think it's prudent. And last year, especially with Zach's edition of Mentel, that was really a good way to reach a lot of people. And I watched Mentel and I saw how many thousands of men were adhering to and staying up and staying tuned to the videos that were being posted from coast to coast. Right. And I thought it was something that was really desperately needed. And I was happy to be a part of that and share some information for myself. So I think we should figure out a way to do that today. I was gonna talk about I was trying to think that, you know, Christopher Hitchens, in putting on this theatrical display, it's like he poisoned his own soul with his own arrogance. Or maybe because he had dedicated his entire life or the later part of his life to these arguments against religion. It's like he had no more space anymore for compassion and empathy. And I think men, it's easy for men to do that in all aspects of your life. So you got a big, powerful, strong man who is doing, like, let's say job A, and that could be in the service industry, could be a lawyer, you could be anything as a man. And the moment that you are challenged by somebody else, you do the exact same thing as what Christopher Hitchens did in a lot of his arguments. You argue on the basis of your own bias, and men get themselves in trouble because when you're mentally unwell, that's one of the first self-defense mechanisms of an unwell person, is to defend their unwellness with lies. Right. I can remember doing that myself.
Back up, the old saying goes, put your back up against the wall, you get your back up.
How do men come out of the shadows of that and finally become free? That seems to be one of the great arguments, especially for men's mental health, is that there's a massive level of social status associated with being mentally healthy and not asking for help that I think men really struggle with, Sean. Maybe, you know, and I was thinking that might be a good starting point, because I know that for most men, to kick off your own betterment, you have to talk to somebody. You have to admit that you need to better yourself, and that seems to be the big struggle. And so maybe I could ask you and put you on the spot here and maybe get a little bit of vulnerability out of Spock for a few minutes.
Bring it.
Well, what did you do? I mean, you what? Yeah. There. Okay.
It's tough with a mirror, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the weird camera. Eh? Yeah. What the hell? Puts 10 pounds on and makes us dumber.
Well, I don't look too bad with an extra 10 pounds.
You're looking pretty good, buddy.
I've already got a 10-gallon head, so I better
it's
be careful.
It's that lighting that you've got.
Tell the audience, what was it about your scenario that allowed you to, because I know that you, when you found out, I've heard you say, yeah, you were like, all right, good, let's figure this out. So where did that vulnerability take you? How did you manage to, right off the hop, just be like, okay, man, let's do this?
Yeah, well, where it took me was on a path that I was unexpected. And the path was shaped by the people around me, like the troops, like you, like the collective, like anyone who touched base with me. So, you know, when I was diagnosed with PTSD or officially told that I had PTSD, it was actually not much of a, it was a non-factor in Jocko language. But it wasn't much of a big deal. I was just happy to hear it was something that I could sink my teeth into. And I've spoken about that in the past. But as the days unraveled, nothing really changed for me per se. It's not like, you know, a light switch went on and my life magically changed in a second. All that changed was my focus on a title. And the title PTSD was, now I'm going to learn a lot more about it. Now I'm going to smash it, as I've stated in the past. So what does smashing mean? That means that not only was I applying a lot of my resources, my time, my intellect against the problem. And by against, I mean not with. Like initially, I was considering it as a foe. So I had to learn its strengths and weaknesses. I had to learn how I could manipulate it. I had to learn how to outflank it. And so as the foe initially, I had to do that classic situation, mission, execution, service and support, command and SIGS mentality, where it became a mission set. And so with a mission set in mind, defeat the foe, we'll call it simply. I had to learn the battle space. I had to formulate my strategy. And then I had to start executing against my strategy with tactical bounds, bit by bit by bit. And as I was executing my battle space, I was observing the people around me, and they were helping shape me along. Because in my big picture sense, as I was, you know, addressing mental health on a personal level, it's not like the world stopped around me. I still had lots of friends who were reaching in and saying, hey, Sean, I'm struggling with dot, dot, dot. Hey, Sean, what are your thoughts on XYZ? Hey, Sean. So I had me, and then I had the rest of the world. So they never became separate. They never became, okay, y'all just be quiet for a second. It's all about Sean for a few years. You got to keep living your life. And fortunately, Jay, my life at the time, I'd set it up so that the people around me were involved with me. And so they were asking questions. They were asking the questions that I should have been asking years ago when I didn't know about a thing called PTSD. And their questions were prompting me to think about things. So where I'm at today is a result of me creating a mission set called Understand and Defeat PTSD, as a loose term. But simultaneously, while I was on my mission set, I had a big team wrapped around me who were kind of not only tracking what I was doing, but they threw on their combat boots and joined me in the patrol to go smash as well. And so, you know, I'm shaped by the outward forces that are around me, and I'm shaped by the inward forces around me. And that is about as loose an explanation as I can give.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I believe there's a bit of I think it's like a 1-to-1 ratio. And when I look back on my own, I see that now. And it was such an invisible thing. That's a really terrible word to use, thing. Once you say, I need some help, once you initiate that process, it's all of a sudden like you scrub the Vaseline out of your eyes and you realize that you're surrounded by people that want to help you. You just can't see it. It seems like, especially some men, for me, 100% that I have been like this my whole life until recently. Something's wrong. I just do it myself. I don't ask for help. Mm-hmm. Maybe in my past as a child, I felt like I didn't get the help. So I decided just to always do it on my own. And whatever problem came, I would figure it out on my own. But this was one of those ones where I couldn't do it on my own, obviously. And that's why I was going downhill. I was pushing away the community around me. Everybody was asking me, hey, are you okay, Jay? My doctor asked me. I had multiple, you know, medical exams and lied. And my wife was constantly asking me and some of my close friends. And everybody around was there prepared for just for me to say, I'm not that okay. Give me a hand. And then bam, there's the community. Right. It's like it's right there. It's like the vampire at the door, but you got to invite the vampire in, you know.
Yeah, right.
You
can't tapping on the window.
Yeah. And I don't know. They don't want to suck your blood. They want to help that's you right. with PTSD,
that's,
I guess.
That's right. It's
the PTSD vampire. And how crazy. What a sad and lonely thing. And what a paradox is that you can't get the help until you say you want the help. And it's right there, man. Like it's literally a doorway away. You grab the door, you open Indeed. It, you say hello, and boom, there's all the help. And it's all around you. And there's very few people. I think there's very few people on planet Earth right now that wouldn't have at least a few people on their team if they said, hey, man, can you give me a hand?
Oh, hang on a sec, though. I do have a counter to that. And sure. It's not a mean-spirited counter. It's not like I've been waiting for Jay to get to this point so I can ambush you with it. It's just the thought that popped up into my head, and I feel like it's got to be said because it's a fuller sense of what we're talking about right now. So I agree wholeheartedly with what you just said, except there's a small slice of the community that almost refuses to address their mental health because they currently have as many eyeballs on them as they want because they complain a lot. Mm-hmm. And the complaining never stops. And so by complaining, it can take all sorts of forms, but it can be something as simple as this. And this has literally been happening for months and months and months and months with an individual that I'm thinking of right now. On social media, Instagram is where I basically only hang out. Yeah. And so he'll put up little, almost like little posters or little memes that are always addressing PTSD. And it's, I can't help who I am. I need help for who I am. And it's a lot of moaning and it's a lot of whining. And the reason I use moaning and whining specifically as terms, because it's constant repetitive messaging that is complaining about how difficult life is. But tomorrow, nothing has been done to change that.
Yep.
And so every single day, it's this repetition of whining about how difficult life is. Well, life is difficult unless you do something to address that. Nothing will change by tomorrow. The whining and the problems are identical tomorrow as they are today, unless you do something about it. Now, my problem is, personally, that I'm a guy who doesn't care for the boy who cried wolf. And so if you've got a problem with wolves, let me know and I'll come and help you out. But if you keep saying there's wolves on my property every single day for a year, but there's no wolves in the area, there's going to be a day when I don't show up. And that is the way I am. I have a line in the sand where an action is repeated so much that I project out into the future and predict that this is never going to end. And I don't want to listen to endless complaining. What I want is endless action. And until you can get to the action part, pal, I've got to move along because I cannot stomach the relentless complaining without action. So there is a slice that does not work for me in respect to supporting someone who's having mental health struggles. And that might sound callous, but to protect my mental health, I can't be around people who relentlessly complain every single day, but do nothing about it to change their circumstances.
I agree. A little while ago, somebody reached out to me and was looking for some help for their spouse. And so I offered some help, not as a therapist or anything, just as a person who's got some experience in life. And I followed this married couple and offered assistance to both of them. And then some time went by and the spouse reached out again and asked for some more help, and I had to decline. And it's that thing. And so I said to her this kind of allegory. You know, if somebody's out in the water and they're drowning and you're in the lifeboat and you throw them the little dinghy and then you pull it back and they're not in it, you're going to throw it back and try again. And you might do that a few times, but you're not going to do it so that you falls off and then you're no longer able to take care of yourself. And that's kind of the people you're speaking of. And it's unfortunate that there are those out there that get trapped in like, I don't know if this is a real word or if this is a real term, but it's like they get trapped in their own depression and anxiety bias, where they have structured their life around their mental health illness or the emotional challenges they have, such that it's the suit they put on the moment that they wake up in the morning, and it's the suit that they go to bed with in at bedtime. And you can't break them out of it, you know? It's like the symbiosis, like the Venom Spider-Man thing. And they just can't pull that sadness or that anxiety off of them because they identify with it. And I think there's probably, in a poisonous way, there's probably some comfort in that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, some people are more comfortable smiling in hell than being challenged in heaven. You can say that 1,000 ways. And I do see that in people. And I'm different than you, Sean, and no offense. I know you won't be offended, but
that's a good thing.
I have another level to my compassion that I give people probably more patience than you would. However, I'm not going to let my own arm fall off by throwing a rubber dinghy to somebody who isn't going to grab onto it and be saved from drowning. Eventually you have to move on, and you hope that person does something. But not everybody can be saved. That's a tough thing to learn, especially if you're in the business of helping guide people or mentor them. You can't mentor everybody, or else you're gonna be drowning in their own problems, and it's gonna become yours. And I don't even know what you do with those kind of people.
Well, I tell you what you can't do is you can't be in your rubber dinghy, or you can't be in your boat about to throw out a life preserver, and do it thoughtlessly. And so let me just paint a quick scenario. So perhaps you've only got one life preserver with no rope attached to it, and you only get one throw, but there's 10 people out there. Now you've got to make choices. That's called time and resource management, of which we don't have infinite. And so every day I'm trying to determine who am I going to interact with today to try to be useful to the world. And that might sound like a little algorithmic, but at 60, I'm on algorithmic time, and I have to use it wisely. And so there's that aspect, the one throw life preserver decision. But then there's the other one where there's a rope attached to the life preserver, and you get to keep throwing it, and eventually your arm wears out. Okay, that's another issue. But then there's the third, and that is you've got no life preserver, but someone's out there floundering in the water yelling for help, and you know they're in dire straits, but you still got to do the algorithm, you got to do the math, and that is, when I get out there to save that person, they look like they're in such a state where they're not thinking, they're irrationally lashing out at the water, just trying to survive for another few seconds, that the moment that I get to them, they're dragging me underwater to try to stay afloat. And if you've ever played with anyone who thinks they're drowning, that's what sometimes they'll do.
Mm-hmm. They're gonna, you become the life preserver
as the part of the life. That's the way it is.
And yeah, so you're the water wings.
You're now the water wings. Yep. And so are you prepared for that? And so there are various scenarios when you're trying to help someone that you have to kind of almost do the math on, as hard and cold and calculated as it sounds, that you can save someone the following day by not drowning with the person who is not in a state of readiness to be saved. And so, you know, how do you walk past someone who needs help? Well, I think we do it all the time. You know, I really do, unaware and aware, but we're all doing math. We're all doing what's good for us, what's good for our family, what's good for our community, what's good for our world, what's good for me tomorrow, what was good for me yesterday. We're all doing math. And part of that math is, how can I make my life better a minute from now? Versus the contextuality of, my life yesterday wasn't good for the following reasons, and I don't want any of that today. It was yesterday. And so we're seeking the good, trying to stay away from the bad. And somewhere in that spectrum is, a guy who's sitting on a sidewalk looking scrubby with a tin cup in his hand that says, could you spare a dime? And that's what we've got in society right now to some degree, no?
Yeah. And some people need a dime and some people need a dollar.
Correct.
Right. And so you're talking about that analysis. I'm really challenged by this, Sean. I've always been told that I'm too empathetic, and maybe that downfall of mine, but where do those people go? You know, I know these people, and in fact, I think I have an idea who the person you were previously talking to is. But where do those people go? Who helps those people, and what is it that we offer them? I've been trying to rack my brain on this, because that seems one of the key things that I've learned is that anxiety and depression is exacerbated by the person with anxiety depression, because you constantly think about anxiety and depression. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it's a snake eating its own tail, and you've got to break that cycle somehow. How did I break my cycle? I think I did it when I started to learn about gratitude and mindfulness. Mm. And so I constantly think about this, especially because I'm in a space now where, like you, maybe not as intense as you, because I don't have the experience or the expertise like you, but I get direct messages every day, people reaching out and asking for some guidance or some information, because I've been through XYZ. And I wish that was one. This is one of the great problems I have. There's a person who's been reaching out to me, and her spouse just can't turn the corner. Just her spouse is stuck in this scenario where all they can do is think about how awful their life is with PTSD, and it's just drowning them. And the spouse has been reaching out to me, and I've offered every modality that I can. And what I can't offer is that little shiny coin, that little spark, that thing that says, this is the thing you do. And then all of a sudden you can turn your day around, right? It's that moment you wake up in the morning, and instead of putting on your depression suit, you give the depression suit the finger, and you put on a fresh set of clothes, and you try and do something a little better that day. But those are just words to say. To mm-hmm. be able to make somebody do that action, that's the secret sauce. That's the magic. There's like some sort of special fairy dust you got to sprinkle on people to get them there. And I don't know what it is. Do you? Do you have? Have you got it?
I do. I've got some okay. secret sauce Good. Up my sleeve. Just hang on a sec. No, I've got nothing up there. But just hang on a
yeah,
sec.
Yeah, up my sleeves here. Yeah.
I'll say this, it's not like it's a novel thought that just popped into my head. It's been in my mind since we jumped into this little trajectory that we're in right now for about the last 10 minutes. And it is a podcast, the Joe Rogan podcast. I can't remember the guest's name. She's a female. She had kind of a psychiatrist vibe about her. Anyway, if I find the clip, I'll send it to you later. But my point is this, that I just happened to be watching the clip randomly. Mm-hmm. And the main thrust of the topic was the number one cause of depression is depression and not doing anything about it. Mm-hmm. And so the idea being that the more you think woe is me, well, the more you're going to be woe is me. And you got to break out of that routine. And so, again, to paraphrase quite simply, get to work. Just do something. Do any action. Do something positive. Stop moaning. Stop whining. Yeah. Break out of your habitual whine fest for the last several years. Try something new. Don't whine today. Stop hanging your hat on the hat hook called today it's all about me complaining. Don't complain today or this week. You hit the nail on the head, Jay, and that is gratitude. My wife used to beat me upside of the head with have an attitude of gratitude, because mm-hmm. I didn't have enough of an attitude of gratitude, apparently. Well, looking back on it, when she would be saying that to me, she was right. Yeah. But at the time, I didn't get it, because like I had gratitude. I was just freaking glad to be alive, glad to be able to smash on a bike, glad to enjoy coffee, glad to enjoy the simple things in life. But at the same time, I would be complaining like, man, I'm wiped out. I'm not getting, like, I'm tired. I'm this, I'm that. And it was just things that I couldn't fix that were, I could feel dragging me down, and it felt like I had no other solutions because I'm a science-minded guy. I'm a curious guy, and I'd spent a lot of years trying to fix Sean, and I was finding myself coming to a point where I was slowing down on my solutions, my little tricks and tips that would keep me moving further at the rate that I wanted, at the velocity that I liked. And so, again, it wasn't until my doc said, you got PTSD, and then, you know, try Prazosin, and that might help strip out the nightmares. And bam, that night I got good sleep. And then bam, I've been having good sleep for a couple of years now, and it's freaking awesome. But until the day that I said, man, I got to do something more, I'd been complaining a little bit, but not to the degree where it was the boy who cried wolf. I was always actively seeking a way to get better, but I'd almost run out of ideas. And then my default was to, I can't fix this. And so I had a little bit of whining in me. And so my wife was hitting me with the attitude of gratitude, and she was right.
Yeah, that's a self-defense mechanism built into the ego. And I've seen this in myself. I see it in my kids. I see it in anybody. Tell anybody to calm down. Tell anybody to just, you know, stop having such a, you don't need relax, to have a bad day. Bro. Just relax, man. Just chill out. And what happens? There is this insane defense mechanism built into the human mind that we would rather just be angry, even if it means staying on fire. Right? Like if the point was, if you can be a little more calm, the fire goes out. Or you just stay angry and mad and wallow in your own self-pity, and you stay on fire. And for some strange reason, most likely because there's actually no real physical pain involved in it, it's so easy to choose your current scenario. It's so easy to not change. And change is one of the difficult things, I think, built into this, is that it really is as simple. And I talked to my teenage boy about this because he is just something else right now, man. Oh man, teenagehood is wild, eh? As a parent, like, oh, man, I don't have, sometimes I don't have a hammer big enough to hit him on the head with, but
keep looking.
Yeah. But I catch myself, you know, telling him to calm down, or, you know, just don't worry about it. Don't think about those things. And I think about how stupid that is later when I say it. So much easier said than done. The real truth is, like you said, the real truth is just stop complaining, stop whining about your scenario, and do something. Because depression and anxiety pulls us out of the moment. And life is all of our series of moments. Life is not pining over our memory. I just made a video of this. I don't know if you watched my last Sunrise video.
Yeah, I did.
Sunrise
it was good. I like you liked it.
And that's one of the keys, and it's not my original thing. I'm only stringing words together the way that I string words together. It's been psychiatrists and psychologists and research scientists that I've listened to that say the key to avoiding your depression is to stop thinking about it. The key to overcoming your anxiety and your depression is to not ruminate on them. And that's where mindfulness and gratitude really pulls you out, because you have to be in the moment. If you've ever tried gratitude by just being thankful in a fleeting way, oh yeah, I'm real thankful for that. That's not real gratitude. Yeah. It won't do you anything. It won't do you any good. You really have to be in the moment.
$2 tip on lunch is not gratitude either. So
No, it's not. Gratitude requires some gratitude and mindfulness are a synergy. You can't have one without the other, I believe. I don't think that you can actually
to do it well. Yeah.
Sure. To really be deeply grateful, where you actually, in fact, enjoy your life and the things that you have, you have to be mindful of a whole host of characteristics that encompass life and what that means. You know, you hear people bitching about their life, and it's like, does your life really suck? And some people in a bad mood be like, yeah, man, my life sucks right now. Okay, tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., we'll take your life for you. Who'd wake up and be like, yeah, okay, sounds good? Nobody. Because life is actually not bad. It's just the choices and the consequences that are bad, right?
It's the inner narrative. Life is the inner narrative. The life that you're living, that I'm living, that everyone's living, it is the inner narrative that we're living. Mm-hmm. The external world is there. We're sensory beings. We're interacting in it, and it's all good stuff. But how you choose to interpret the external world within your internal world through your internal narrative. That's the magic sauce, if there's any at all. Yep. And I mean, yesterday we spoke about it for 2 hours. The philosophy of choice was the topic on the Collective Podcast.
I haven't watched it yet, so
that's okay. I rewatched it last night for you. And so the conversation as a whole, it touches on this subject to some degree. And at the end of it all, if I was to distill down the 2 hours, which is impossible, but it all comes down to, hey, man, we all get to choose what we do next. We all get to choose what we tell ourselves. It is all choice if you realize that you have the choice. But to tie it into this topic today, you don't have choice if you give it away by accepting your reality that you can't change anything, that your suck is always going to suck, that the depression is eternal. That is the power of choice. You give away your choice. You give away your power. The moment that you start believing that your reality that you exist in right now is fixed, that is a loser mentality. Literally, it's a loss, not a win. And yep. So in order to get back your power in the moment, the power of your life, you have to accept the idea that life is about choices, that only you can choose. You can be influenced by people around you. You can be almost obligated by a series of circumstances in the external world that are directly in front of your nose, like as the buses warp factor threeing towards you as you cross the street. You have a choice in the moment. And some of these choices are quite fixed in that I got to get out of the way of the bus. Mm-hmm. But other choices have more divergent options than just get out of the way of the bus. You can have multifaceted choices in a single moment of choice. But you'll never have that granularity of understanding until you start making choices that are different than the choices you've been making up till now, which have got you to the point where you have no power, no personal power. You've given it away because you've given away your choice.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That almost sounds like you're saying it's the difference between perception and perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Am I hitting that right? Because perspective is an infinite source of viewing reality. But perception is just a one-sided plane. Because perception is just what you have as your senses and how you experience that through consciousness. And everybody thinks that's the be-all and end-all of their life, right? I'm experiencing this, so it must be. And the big takeaway, like you said, is that all you have to do is change your perspective. And now you're on another temporal plane, right? It's like as simple as smiling. Do you know how stupid that is? And you know how difficult it is?
And it's so powerful. Oh,
God. It's embarrassing. And I mean, it's embarrassing metaphorically and literally.
Yeah, it is.
Having a bad mood, just freaking smile. And you know what? As dumb as that sounds, and you could take the most macho guy, and if you make him smile, you don't feel as bad. I don't care what's going on. I mean, sure. I wouldn't ask somebody to do that at a funeral or, you know, in particular situations where it's okay to have your emotions. But if you woke up and you're just having a shitty day and you literally can order yourself to smile, you'll end up laughing because it's so embarrassing to make yourself smile. Initially, and why? We all do it naturally, right?
Yeah, I know. You know? Initially, it's embarrassing. And initially, it's weird. And it's a bit trippy. But after a while, for everyone who's listening to this, after a while, it becomes normal. And then after a while, it's beyond normal. It's just fun. Yep. It's fun to be fun. It's fun to hang around with cool people who are fun. It's fun to have a fun life. It's fun to have the power to make the choices to how much fun you want to have in that day. And so you talked about elevating yourself to a higher temporal order, or a higher level of dimensional awareness, we'll call it. How about this? Just get higher elevation. So wherever your house is, go climb 1,000 feet higher and sit on a mountain and enjoy the view. Enjoy the freaking chickens chirping in the background. Enjoy the world around you. the fun noises, the happy noises, the noises of life, which don't exist in your basement in the dark while you're bummed out. The only noise, the only background noise is the noises in your head and whatever you've got on the big screen in front of your nose called Netflix or whatever, that is not satisfying your soul. It's leeching time out of your soul. It is not giving time to your soul. Your soul is shrinking every minute that you sit in the dark and ruminate on the same ideas that are the boy who cried wolf whining moments. Get out to a higher elevation. Look out at the sun. Look out at the rain. Look out at anything that's different, that will give you a different angular perspective on your life. From high up to look down on the little town that you're ruminating in. Get outside of your existence to look at it as an existence so that you can see how much more you can provide within your existence.
Well, and doesn't that pull you out of the past and the future when you're able to enjoy that moment, right? Like if you had to climb up a mountain to get a beautiful view, wouldn't you just be dedicated to that at those times? And wouldn't that be such a relief?
Unless you got halfway up and you're like, oh, it's raining. And by the time I get up there, there'll be no view. And now I'm wasting my time. And this is even worse than my basement. It's perspective.
Yeah. You can switch anxiety to opportunity, right?
I believe.
Yeah. Because if you can learn to understand that depression and anxiety are rooted in the past and the future, it's hard to realize at first, especially when you're sad. It's hard to realize when you're really at the lowest point of mental health or mental illness, I should say. It really is difficult for anybody to come up to you and say, hey, man, you know, you just go climb up that mountain and sit down for a while and have a look at the view. You'll be fine. The reality is, Sean, and you know, we both know this, that there's nuance built into this, and it doesn't happen over one moment of the day. You wake up one day and then the next day you're back to your normal life. No, it takes repeated practice. It takes consistency in creating discipline, and then discipline becomes routine, and then routine becomes unconscious, and then that unconscious becomes your life. And, you know, there are steps. We're talking because we're on a podcast and we only have a little bit of time. The reality, though, is doing these things are the key. But it's not doing it once. You know, it's not like Tylenol. When you have a headache, you take a couple of Tylenol, your headache goes away. The next day, you're fine. You don't need to take Tylenol. When it comes to wellness overall, this is an everyday, all-day thing. You know, you've got to, A, say, okay, today's the day I am going to make a change and not put on my depression clothes. Agreed. But then the next day, if you put your depression clothes back on, you're kind of at square one again, right?
Agreed.
Right. You need to take probably at least 5 or 6 steps forward before you can be like, oh, I'm having a crummy hour. Or I'm having a crummy day. And then the next day you get back on. If that consistency is not there, you can climb a mountain once. It won't do any good. You got to climb the mountain every day. In this allegorical way, the mountain becomes the way that you're overcoming this by seeing gratitude, by seeing the present moment and being mindful with your life and in the moments that you have.
I think there's two things that a person has to do in parallel. And so using your depression clothes as the example, which is great. And so, you know, the person takes off their depression clothes, puts on their new clothes, which is called, I'm about to start climbing the mountain. When you get home, you should have done two things. The first thing is pat yourself on the back for walking a third of the way up the mountain in the rain and being miserable and still freaking walking for a bit. And then eventually you get soggy, you're bummed out, you turn around, you head back. Well, good. You started building out your anti-fragileness. Because if you're bummed out by a little bit of rain, a little bit of gray clouds, a little bit of this walk is too hard, you're fragile. That's it. That's all. You're fragile. You need to start building resilience in order to become anti-fragile. So eventually you can walk right to the top of the mountain, sit in the worst, heinous thunderstorm you've ever sat in, and smile because it's a non-factor. You're trying to become anti-fragile, you're trying to build your resilience, you're trying to get used to being cold, wet, and hungry, for lack of a better term. But then when you're at home, patting yourself on the back for being out in the rain a bit, you then need to throw away a sock from your depression suit so that you can't pull on that depression sock anymore. And bit by bit, you throw away the other sock, then the shirt, then the pants, then the jacket, then the tie. now you've got no more freaking depression suit. And I think that that is kind of an important aspect of it as the analogy. You can go out there every single day and start humping up that mountain and get a little bit further every time, and you get a little bit wetter, you get a bit colder, you get a bit better at it. Now you're an explorer, now you're an adventurer. But if you keep coming back to your house and that depression suit is sitting there in the corner, there's always a potential that you want to start pulling back on the depression socks again. And I'm saying that it's a twofold process. You go out there and you kick some ass, and then when you get back, you start dumping the garbage that wasn't serving you well. Make sense?
Yeah, it's like being a functional depressionist.
Yeah, right, it is.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, like I know lots of people that are functional alcoholics. They have on paper and in public, they have a fine life. And they're good people. And they're not even bad people when they're drunk. But at 5 p.m., they become somebody else. And so they go to work and they do their job and it's okay and everything's fine. And then behind the scenes, they're still... And I know people that are like, I just made that up. I don't know if it's a real word.
You could have used functional flyologist. I mean...
Oh, the mosquitoes are so freaking bad, and I'm standing outside today.
It's freaking awesome. I'm loving it. So I've got, fragile.
I've got like 45% DEET musk all here.
Right. Melts plastic.
Oh, it literally does. You got to be careful where you spray it.
I know.
Where were we?
Depressionist.
Well, what I was going to say was I used to think that there were levels of compassion for everybody. I used to think that there were a group of people that needed the soft touch the entire time. Like the whole, it's okay who you are. It's okay that you're sad. Rinse, repeat. But I don't think that that's a way that we can, as a society, deal with depression and anxiety and mental health at some point. There's a breaking point. So I think what you do is you're kind of in this sort of inverse relationship. As people are getting better, you have to turn the dial up on the getting better. And then you have to stop watering down the language that you're using to speak with them. Because eventually, and I'll use the example that you started with, eventually somebody's got to say to the person who constantly is complaining, enough's enough. Yeah. All right. You've been down that road for a while. Enough's enough, or you can go have dinner in a different room, or I don't know, you know, like I like you, dude, but I'm gonna eat over here.
Yeah.
Right. And I used to believe that you had to give everybody that soft touch forever, but I think that's part of the problem. I really think it is. It's like taking away all of bullying, you know?
Yeah. That was the Joe Rogan podcast point that she went on to make at a further point.
Yeah.
And that is, look, right now, there's just a lot of people who are, and this is so generally paraphrased, but there's a lot of people out there that are used to and prefer to be coddled rather than told, hey, man, like, you've come here a lot and nothing's changing, so now we're going to do it a different way. Let's try something new that might move the needle. And that new is, I'm tired of you whining. Let's get to work.
Yep.
Stop doing nothing but complaining. Let's ditch the complaining. Let's inject some action.
Yep.
I think it's such a simple recipe that everyone is aware of, that some people ignore, but the people who don't ignore it are the people who are currently doing it and just know it to be true as a powerful tool to cause change. Action is change. But action is sweaty and dirty and hard and unusual if you haven't been used to action. And so what a person, I believe, needs to do is commit to action, but not commit to this hellacious definition of blood, sweat, and the tears that they've built up into their head that they think that they're going to have to face in their very first moment of action. That is not true. The action that you subscribe to is all under your control. It is your tool to wield. All you need to do is focus on change through action. You don't have to turn the action into freaking instant action, man, where you're 1,000%ing the chin-up bars, though you've never been on a chin-up bar for a decade. No one has to dial the rotary dial so far to the right that the world flashes out in a blast of white light because it was so intense. Mm-hmm. Ease into action so that you can engage in it over the long term. Don't decide today that you're going to make a change and that change is going to be a million mile forced march with 1,000 pounds on your back until your feet fall off. No one has to turn it into a freak show on day one. Ease in order for it to last long.
Yeah, that's like the key to everything in life. I think that's why people fail at everything, including getting on exercise or changing their diet or improving their lifestyle, right? It's like, I'm going to go and buy $300 pair of runners and go run a half marathon for my first run, and I've never ran before.
That's right.
And then you've got shin splints and fractures in your toes, and you never run again because you went insane and you did it way too crazy. I've had a tendency to do that in my life. It's been part of my personality, you know, 1,000 miles an hour at every wall, yeah. Right?
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. You're still here and you still got a positive attitude and et cetera, et cetera. It didn't break you. What it did was give you life lessons on Jay, on who you are, getting to know yourself better. And then being able to talk about what you've learned about Jay and how it might be able to help someone else in the future that's nearby. And so we're supposed to explore ourselves, as you just suggested, and bump into ourselves, as you just suggested. If not, then what's it all about, you know? If you're not trying to see who you are, then are you actively trying to not see yourself, you know?
Well, you say this a lot, you know, you got to look at it with a fresh set of eyes. And that's the whole changing your perspective. You can't change your perception. You know, your skin is your skin, your eyes are your eyes, your ears are your ears. You know, you can't change the way that your five senses bring electricity to your brain in order to map reality. That's the way it is. But you can mentally change your perspective. You can think as though you were somebody else. You can think as though you're a happy person versus a sad person. Right? You can pretend that today is going to be a good day and you can force a smile on your face. You can take a moment to look at something as though you were something else. And in doing so, like, what would this look like if I wasn't in a bad mood? Can I visualize myself doing this task without the sadness? Am I capable of bringing myself to the present moment in order to do this thing now? And can I leave the thoughts of my past and what has happened or my fear of what may be in the future so that I can be in the moment? Can I change the way I actually see reality mentally? Because you can't change it physiologically, but can I do this mentally? And it's certainly not a tool that we teach people. We don't teach kids that. And I don't remember in the policing world, people talking to us about mental health. I'm certain in the military, they didn't have the road to mental readiness and
certainly
mental health training right beside the Sniper 101 course and
yeah, the conversation
how to sneak up on
like
bad
this.
Guys. yeah, exactly. And up until a few years ago in my policing career, it wasn't there either. But I think it's important to be able to see your life through your own shift in perspective. Like, what if I just, for today, tried something else? Right? Woke up and put on a different shirt other than the shirt I've been wearing for the last 5 years, last 2 years, last 10 years of my life. It's not working. This shirt makes me sad. So why can't I put something else on? And changing perspective will do that. It's a mental game. And these mental games we play, like, have you heard of Mel Robbins? Have you heard of Mel Robbins do that? Like high five yourself?
No, but I've heard her. It's a she, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think she's a public speaker and a psychologist or something.
Yeah.
So she does all of these weird things, all these weird mind games, and I've tried them out, and I found them so funny that I was laughing, and I can see why people would be apprehensive of doing these things because we're embarrassed when we're alone by ourselves, doing things that might be good for us. So one of the things she has is this thing where you tell yourself you love yourself in the mirror. And then you give yourself a high five, like a shadow high five in the mirror. And it's embarrassing. Anybody that's listening, go try to do it. See if you can physically make yourself do it, number one. Most people can't even get to the point of going in front of a mirror, looking at themselves in the eyes, and then going, "I love you, man." Most people can't do it. And therein lies the problem. Therein lies one of the great problems, is we are really, really terrible company for ourselves. We're really good at being company for other people, but then when it comes down to us, we're terrible, terrible company. We're embarrassed of our own nudity. We're scared of looking at ourselves in the eyes and having a conversation with ourselves. We're scared of fighting the demon and the angel on our shoulders. We're scared of altering our conscience and saying that there's a different way to be. And nobody, not a single person, can see inside here to hear your mental processes, to hear you talking about yourself and saying, "Hey, man, I love you. I love you today. I love myself. High five myself in the mirror." And you could go and have a better day. And we're embarrassed of this. Why? Why are we embarrassed, Sean, of our own internal mental thoughts? Because what is it again? What is hearing this to be embarrassed against? You know, it's like the homunculus in my brain. It's like moving all the little wires is laughing at me, smiling, or what? I don't know.
I think it comes down to several things, but the first thing that comes to mind is self-confidence. And so I'm going to just a quick scenario. I was up on the mountain there just a couple days ago with my wife. It was her 52nd birthday week/month/year. Every day is a birthday day over the last few days for Doreen.
She's got multiple, I guess. Yeah. Where's my third present, John?
We're out on second Z's breakfasts.
Yeah.
and so we're up on the mountain. And I've got a stick in my hand, and I'm just about to kick the stick. And there's some dude who is just walking up the mountain. He's taking his sweet time. And I'm standing there waiting for him to come up. And he's looking at me like, "What's your problem?" I said, I just want to kick a stick. I'm just waiting for you to get out of the way. There's a safe arc. I'm going to make sure that you're not in it. So come on up. Don't worry. And he's being apprehensive, and it's a bit of a drama. And so this guy's energy was off right from the get-go. He was not digging whatever I was about to do because it just wasn't his thing. And he's kind of chirping at me a little bit. And not chirping mean-spirited, because that would have worked out a bit different. But he's kind of chirping with a bit of attitude, but not so much attitude that now I'm going to target lock him and say, "What did you say?" And so he's just kind of playing it smart. And he's standing back behind me now as I'm about to throw the stick. And he's stood there only to watch me fail. He's not standing there to see me kick the stick. He was never there for the cheer. He was there for the laugh. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And so as I threw it up, first timed it, off it goes into the stratosphere. The stick is still in the air as I'm going around in slow motion, plant my foot. And as I'm planting my foot, I'm already target locking him. But I can see the stick in my periphery, like still heading towards 47 mountain ranges away. And so I hear him say, "Oh, good thing it wasn't an air bomb." Like, he's got attitude and he's hitting me with the, "You kind of got lucky there." And as I planted my foot, I'm already locking him. And I said, "Well, here's the thing that you probably didn't know. I've been doing this a few years." And the reason that I said that is because he was there to see the failure. He wasn't there to see the win. And when the win condition was achieved, he was turning on his heel, disappointed that I'd been successful, because he wanted to see me be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. He wanted to see me struggle in the moment to explain myself. What that dude doesn't know about me is whether I kick it or whether it hits the dirt is a non-factor to me, because I've been in that moment more times than that guy has blinked his eyes, probably. And so he just doesn't know me, but yep, he thought he did. And so he was standing there for the wrong reason, because win, lose, or draw, I'm going to be okay with who I am, because I'm confident.
Yep.
It could have landed the point first in my foot, and I could have been bleeding out, and I would have looked at him and smiled, because that dude, his assessment of who I am is not a part of my concern, because I'm a self-confident guy. Now, why am I self-confident? Because I'm not fragile, because I've had my ass kicked, because I'm resilient, because I push my pace every single day, because I am a guy who doesn't hide in his basement in depression. I'm a guy who gets out in the world and kicks its ass. And that gives me confidence. And confidence will take you a lot of places. And if it's not taking you places in the external world, confidence will take you a lot of places in your internal world. The confidence of your self-efficacy, the confidence of your ability to create solutions within your internal world is something that is not only pursuable by anyone, but it is something that will explain to the world who you are by having internal self-confidence. I wish people would pursue it more.
And to the person who's listening, if you are, and you get to this and you're thinking, oh, that's real nice of Sean to say, yeah, I'm self-confident, and that's how I'm able to overcome my mental health problems. And the person, there's a mosquito on the camera.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm enjoying it.
There's a lot of people out there that aren't confident. And
I wasn't at one point, buddy.
Me too.
I mean,
I was a total loser until...
I was a total loser.
Last week or so, I guess.
Performing loser of a kid.
Yeah.
Before I joined the military. And even in the military, I was a bit of a loser initially, I think. Probably. I don't know.
Yeah. But how do you build confidence?
I got squared up.
Right?
I got squared up.
Yeah. But that's what I was getting at was this. And you're a good example of that. A lot of people, if people are listening, they probably don't know your backstory that you're a skinny little dweeb before you got to high school. And I'm not saying that to shit on you. Pardon my language.
I said that on a regular basis. Get my ass kicked. Getting bullied. I mean,
yeah.
Life sucked.
That was my childhood. However, here's the point. People will be thinking, I don't have confidence. No, you don't. But that's exactly the same as what we were speaking of previously. It's just a choice.
It's a choice.
Right? You walk out the door and you don't like your outfit. Of course, you're going to think every single human being is staring at your outfit when nobody is. Right?
No one cares.
Or you could walk out the door and it's as easy as saying the thing out loud in your head. That mental control comes down to saying the thing out loud in your head over and over again. If you wake up every morning of your life, and I'll get back to my point so I don't forget it. If you wake up every morning of your life and the first thing you think of in the morning is, oh, great, another day. Of course, your day's going to suck. Right? I start every day by talking to myself and just saying, today's going to be a great day. Even if it isn't, it starts the day off. And mentally, my mind is starting the day off saying it's going to be great.
Your prime.
Confidence is the same way. And you know, whether you believe guys like Andrew Huberman or all the other really incredibly smart scientists out there on podcasts, confidence comes from doing confident things, literally like thinking that you're confident. Having confidence is just like faking bravery. Right? You can fake confidence and then it becomes confidence. If you're deadly afraid of public speaking and then you go and you successfully public speak, it doesn't mean that you're no longer afraid of public speaking, but it's a demonstration of bravery. And confidence is the same way. You might be shit scared at Safeway while you're walking around with your new outfit on because it's new. Maybe it's a color that that really stands out, or it's a style that's not for everybody. But if that's who you are and you walk around, even if you're shit scared inside, if you walk around with your shoulders back and your head up and your chin out, people are going to think that you're confident. And then when you start to do confident things, even if you're scared inside, eventually your mind is going to be like, scared, but still did. A little less scared, but still did. And eventually you kind of turn the tide on this thing, right? You've invented confidence just like you can invent fake bravery by just doing it. And in doing so, then I think you become confident. There's no other way. And it was kind of like Andrew Huberman talking about the anterior mid-cingulate cortex, that thing that grows when you do hard stuff and that shrinks when you don't. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, we're talking about, how do you get better? Well, if you really wanted to just boil it down to a few words, it's like Nike's famous thing. You just got to do it. In order to get better, you just have to do it. And what we don't know is that the action of doing strengthens everything, including your brain. It strengthens your confidence and your bravery.
And why do people not do that?
Because of a whole host of reasons.
Have the ability to step out their door and be confident. Why do people fail to pick up what you've just said?
Yeah. Society, culture, decades of conditioning.
Not a strong enough why.
Oh, there's a whole host of reasons, Sean. Yeah.
There are.
Yeah.
But on a personal level, you'll never get out your front door. You'll never stop whining. You'll never adventure. You'll never see what's beyond the mountain. You'll never, ever, ever, ever live a full life unless you start squaring away your why you're here, why you're living the life that you're living, and why do you want to live a different life. If your why ain't strong enough, welcome to the depression basement. But if your why is strong enough, welcome to the top of the mountain where the view is pretty freaking awesome.
Yep.
If you're unconfident, that's on you. If you're confident, that's on you. If your life sucks, that's on you. If your life rocks, that's on you. It's all on you. All the choices, all the life, all the things. Where you're at right now is a result of all of that stuff. But where you're at tomorrow is unwritten. That's the beautiful part that a lot of people forget. If your life is hellacious right now, that is freaking on you. But tomorrow isn't on you. It's unwritten. Tomorrow is for you to define. But people give up their sense of agency. People give up their sense of the unwritten story immediately in front of their nose because they feel like their story is written already because of today. That's not the case. Tomorrow is a blank slate for you to frickin' scribble with your chalk or grab a calligraphy brush and paint a masterpiece. And the only thing that's holding you back from the two states, a scribbledy-doo or a magnificent artwork, the only difference between those two things is the intention or why you're about to pick up the chalk or why you're about to pick up the calligraphy brush.
Yeah, I agree. Most people wouldn't trade the problems in their life if they had to randomly accept the problems of somebody else without knowing. Imagine you took 100 people from the world and everybody's got like a car key in their pocket and you threw all the car keys into a center. And then the choice was you can take your own key back and have your own vehicle or you can take somebody else's. And in this metaphor or this allegory, the car keys represent the person's life's problems. Would you take the chance? Like, would you really?
Know, man, like, I think I'd turn on my heel, do a 180, and start walking towards
and say peace
cafe.
Out.
Peace yeah. out, man. I'm gonna run the game my way.
If you think
I've got to choose a key, wrong.
Yeah,
I don't.
If you think you've
keys.
Got it really bad, you haven't had it bad yet.
That's right. Yeah.
Right, because people who have had it really bad, and I mean, my life has been like I've lived like a billionaire compared to some people in this world, and of all of the things that have happened in my life, the challenges I've had, I get embarrassed when I pine over the difficulties and the struggles I've had compared to what has, you know, yeah. compare what it to what been. Life used to be like until like 200 years ago. No matter what has happened to you now in the 21st century, modern day cultural 21st century living, most of what happens to you, it ain't that bad. You're not being eaten by tigers. You're not being raped and mauled by the Mongolian horde. Right? You're not freezing to death in a Russian military camp. It ain't that bad.
It ain't.
And you're so right. It's all just that perspective shift. You can wake up one day, even if your circumstances have been hell, and say, okay, today's the day I'm going to start having a better day. And it's not going to be like that day is the day that your life is awesome now. It's just a little bit better. I see people like when I first met, I had a brief conversation with Mark Omrod after he was on your show. He might even not be happy with me using him as an example of there's somebody who really has gratitude for life. Cause he's probably like, fuck off. I'm living and I'm having fun and I'm challenging myself every day with the circumstances of my life. And he's got a good life and probably doesn't think of himself as a or B, you know, some sort of label. But if you can just objectively look at a person who has had trauma like that, and they're out there smiling and working hard and doing charity events and pushing their physical and mental envelope in order to have something in their life that's worthy, the why that you talk about, you should be fully embarrassed of your thoughts on how sad your life is because you have a paper cut.
Yeah, I agreed.
And I say that, and I say that
as the example as well, for sure. Oh, yeah. In my mind.
Right. I don't know Mark, and I would hate to think that me using him as an example would be detrimental to him, but I don't think so. I think would be a fine example
With him. So.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So for those of you that are listening that don't know, Mark Armrod was, I think he was special forces overseas.
UK Royal Marine.
Right. And after a tragedy, he ended up only having one limb left, one arm left.
One arm. Yeah.
And here's a guy who is doing absolutely incredible things with his life. And he's a fine example. He's like, he's like Viktor Frankl's man search for me. Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. He's like if you took Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl and gave it a body to walk around with.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Like that guy exudes having a why when you mm-hmm. can, when you can overcome that kind of tragedy and still be out there telling people to keep going, you know, because he's got this beautiful outlook on life. And the takeaway at the end of this, because we're close, an hour and 20. The takeaway, I think, was really key when you said that. That's sort of what it all boils down to. In order for you to wake up in the morning and leave your depression suit, or leave one depression sock off, or whatever it is, take the first step out the door, put your running shoes on, pack your gym bag. If that's step one, that's good. It doesn't need to be all or nothing, but you got to have mm-hmm. a why. People don't realize that. It's the simplest thing. Why do you get up in the morning? Why do you continue to be alive? You know, when you read a guy like Albert Camus, when you get into these really existential philosophical debates, the ultimate question is, why do you stay alive and not kill yourself? Clearly, life is so important that no matter how miserable you think your circumstances are, your body and your mind still has the propensity to keep you alive no matter what. And that's for almost everybody. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are people that take their life, and that's a tragedy that we can talk about another time. But what I'm getting at is there is a why. We all have one. You just have to sort of, I think it maybe gets covered up and buried by the constant whining and pining over our situation and constantly thinking on our depression and anxiety instead of thinking on these things like gratitude and mindfulness and the purpose that we have.
I think you're right, but with an overarching waiver on top of that, or a rider on top of what you just said.
Okay.
And I think where it really goes wrong is you have to know your why, of course, but not your why for you singularly. You need to know your why for you and the why for all of those around you. If you're just thinking of your why am I here? Why am I going to wake up tomorrow? Why am I going to sweat blood and tears? Why? Poor old me. That sometimes isn't enough to get a person out of the door. But the moment that you sit back and start moaning to yourself, why do I have to sweat blood and tears tomorrow? For my family, for my community, for me to get my act together so that 3, 4, 5 years from now, I can be a beacon of hope for a person like myself when I was in the Hurt Locker 3, 4, 5 years ago. And so the why for ourselves can sometimes take a back seat because we're just freaking being lazy for ourselves. But the moment that you prioritize it, like for my kids, now that's a different energy. That's not a selfish energy. That is a community-based, that is a planet-based energy that is different than just the singular why moaning. The moment that you have others to perform for, to take care of, to be there for, to roast the meat over the campfire in front of the cave 10,000 years ago, the moment that you've got people to look after or be there for, that changes the why. And so if you are only thinking about woe is me, change that to woe is everyone around me. And that might move your needle.
I think we'll end it there because that's a perfect point to make. And serving other people will really, really, serving other people will really help you break out of that depression. And I've heard this, and I know you know this from experience, and I know this from experience as well. But when you start to worry about other people, you stop worrying about yourself. Mm-hmm. And with that, we're going to end. This is episode 5 of Upon the Horizon. Make sure you like, share, subscribe, hit all of those cool notification things. Thank you for listening and watching. If you made it to an hour 25, Sean and I will catch you again very, very soon. Cheers.
Cheers.